Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Luke McGrath, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is the never-ending bust and how to fix it now. And our guest today is Dr. Mark Thornton. Welcome, Mark.
Luke, it's great to be with you today.
Excellent. Hang on, let me just tell you a little bit about Dr. Thornton. He's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and he served as a faculty member of Auburn University and Columbus State University. He's the author of a number of books, including The Economics of Prohibition and Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War. Okay, now, it's common to hear that practically no one at the time could have seen the unsustainability of the housing boom or the looming financial crisis that was on the horizon, but Dr. Thornton here is an exception, as he wrote a number of very prescient articles well before the crisis hit. In early February of 2004, for example, Mark wrote an article for LouRockwell.com where he said that, quote, "We are going through a housing bubble and stock valuations as measured by stock price to earnings ratios are at bubble levels." And then a few months later, in June of 2004, Mark wrote an article for Mises.org entitled "Housing, Too Good to Be True." And I should perhaps point out that for the listeners that there's not a question mark at the end of the title of that article. That was a statement. Dr. Thornton was describing why, in his view, people were living in a fantasy land if they thought that housing prices were going to continue to keep rising. So before we get on to the main topic of discussion, which is what we need to do to get out of the slump that we now find ourselves in, we should first discuss how we got here in the first place. So would you be able to give the listeners a bit of an idea then, Mark, of what you were seeing when you wrote those articles that so many others at the time were blind to?
Certainly, Luke. You know, everybody else thinks that the business cycle is just part of the economy, that we can't really know about it. Just business people become overconfident, over-speculative, overly greedy. But the Austrians have been studying this question for well over 100 years, and we've come up with an answer as to what causes the business cycle, and it's basically that interest rates get out of sync with reality. What the natural rate of interest in the economy would be compared to what the Federal Reserve is actually setting the interest rate at any particular point in time. And so when we see the Federal Reserve, the central bank, reducing the interest rate, which affects all other interest rates in the economy, including your car loans, your credit cards, your mortgages, and so forth, that can cause a disequilibrium between market forces and what the central bank is trying to achieve. And so that's what we look for, is interest rates that are too small, which then allow people to get loans at too low of rates, which means everything that they invest in becomes profitable, the prices of those investments go up, everybody's winning, and this is what causes the overconfidence. But the problem, of course, is that these people are investing in real goods, physical investments, things that can't quite easily be dissolved once the interest rates change and move higher. And so as a consequence, the Federal Reserve's low interest rates does cause too much speculation, does cause too much investment, does cause male investments in the economy to occur when those low interest rates exist. And then once interest rates rise because of inflation and other forces, the consequence is that all those male investments become observable in the economy as bad investments that are not profitable. And as a result, you know, they go out of business, they have to shut down, they have to cut back, they have to lay off workers, they go into bankruptcy, they go into foreclosure. And so, you know, that's what we were looking at in 2003, 2004, 2005, is the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates low and people investing in way too many houses. I mean, there were a lot of, you know, statistics like housing starts and housing construction, which were way above anything that had ever happened in the past. And so it was quite clear to at least a dozen Austrian economists who were writing at the time that the Fed was engineering a giant boom and that could not be sustained, and that eventually housing prices would have to head much, much lower.
Okay, great. Well, I'll follow up on that with a bit more some specific questions afterwards, but we're just coming up to a break now, so we'll be right back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm talking to Dr. Mark Thornton. Okay, and we're back on Radio Free Market. This is Luke McGraw, and I'm speaking to Dr. Mark Thornton. Now, before the break, Mark, we were talking, you're discussing, just giving a basic explanation of the Austrian theory of the business cycle, specifically, though, with regards to the housing bubble that we've sort of just gone through, or still going through in a way. What were some of the reasons? Why did it go into housing? Why was there, before, I guess it was with it was the dot-com boom, and then the Fed came in and lowered, Greenspan lowered interest rates after that. But why is it that it went into housing predominantly?
Well, that's a very good question. There are always real factors in the economy that affect every single business cycle. So every business cycle is going to be different. And, you know, we had the tech stocks cycle, the boom and the bust then. And this crisis is based on the housing bubble and housing crisis. And in this go-round, basically what we had was we had the federal government encouraging housing by they increased the tax breaks. They increased the amount of mortgage money that was available through Freddie Mae and Fannie Mac, and encouraged banks and actually forced banks to lend money to people who without good credit ratings. And so we had various regulatory factors, the Community Reinvestment Act, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the tax breaks and so forth, all of which encouraged investment into the housing sector. And, of course, this also affects a lot of related industries like real estate sales, furniture sales, and so on, so that every business cycle, especially the large ones, it's not just a boom and a bust, but there's an adjective before it. And in this case, the adjective is housing. It's a housing bubble, the housing crisis, the housing bust. And so the government, the federal government, was funneling that credit that was ultimately being created by the Federal Reserve into housing through tax breaks, regulations, and through its government-established entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
How was it? Would you be able to explain what how it was with people who were extracting equity from their housing? How did that play into it?
Yes, I mean that was really the clearest sign that we were in a highly speculative boom. Is that as housing prices rose, what happened was that people could refinance their homes and take money out of the home, and so as a consequence, they could increase their consumption spending. That's another feature of the Austrian explanation of the business cycle, is that you get simultaneously more investment and more consumption. The interest rates, as the interest rates come down, people will borrow more for consumption, and they'll save less of their money. And so as this housing bubble reached its very peak, the savings rate in the United States became negative. And so, you know, people could take money, could refinance their mortgage, get a big chunk of money, buy a boat or something like that, or build onto their house or go on world vacations or whatever it happened to be, and keep their payments the same. And so these extraordinary low interest rates combined with rising housing prices meant that people could get access to even more cash, cash that seemingly seemed like it was for free because it was the rising housing prices and the rising valuation of homes that allowed that to take place. And, of course, a lot of the lending and a lot of the mortgage industry started making loans on the basis of these rising housing prices, so that lenders felt better about lending money to people with bad credit scores, because if housing prices were rising, well, if housing prices are rising and their borrowers get in trouble, they can come back to the company and refinance that refinance that home, take money out, and that money would then suffice to make future payments. So it was crazy economics and crazy banking and mortgage lending that was going on at the time. And, you know, at the same time, Ben Bernanke, who was then vice chairman of the Fed in 2005, I famously quoted him as saying that he had personally investigated lending practices and housing valuation procedures and had found that there was nothing wrong and that things had actually greatly improved in those two areas. Now, that's what he said it in 2005, and that's precisely when people were doing all sorts of crazy types of home lending where you didn't have to put zero down on a mortgage, interest-only loans, where you could borrow more than the value of the house in some cases so that you could afford furniture and carpeting and so forth. Those are crazy lending practices that existed. And Ben Bernanke was telling everybody in the world that he had personally investigated it and had found not only were things being run very well, but that they were better than ever, and which was completely misleading the public, completely misleading the mortgage financing industry and the home building industry, which allowed even more people to pile in at the very end into this housing bubble, precisely those people who got burned the most as the housing bubble came undone.
I think there was just recently it came out, Bloomberg, I think, procedures have me thousands of pages of documents are all transcripts from, I think it was 2005, 2006, or it was several years ago, of all transcripts of Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meetings, and they were joking in there, some different bits have come out, but they were joking to how they were talking about how some lenders, some real estate developers were selling people houses, and when you buy a house, it would come with like a free Volkswagen Beetle or something. You know, like all these different incentives that they'd put in place just to get people to buy all these extra houses.
Right. At the very end, and, you know, of course, those transcripts, the public statements, you know, from the Fed, everything was fine, everything was great, even as you go into 2006, 2007, and even in 2008, you know, they were still talking about green shoots and so on and so forth. But privately, the members of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee were expressing concerns about lending practices. They were expressing concerns amongst themselves about overvaluation, where the quantity of overall real estate was too large to be sustained, especially going forward. So, you know, they have access to every single statistic involving the economy and then some. And I'm sure they have some special inside statistics that they also follow that we don't have access to. And yet, you know, their public statements were everything was fine, everything is great, everything is dandy. But they were basically misleading the public. They were just misleading the entire economy and encouraging people to do something that they themselves would not have done.
So it wasn't really that people were being greedy or something like that when they were trying to flip houses. They were being quite rational, really. So you put it out, it's the Federal Reserve was the main culprit behind the financial crisis. It wasn't greed or no regulation or something like that.
That's right. I mean, it's not that the fact that business can become overly speculative for no reason, or that they can become overly confident for no reason, or seemingly overly greedy for no reason, that they were being misled. They were given the raw material, which is credit, at a very, very low price. They were being told that you know, it was going to stay that way for a long time. They were being told that everything was fine. And so if you looked at those people and you looked at the history of their experience, well, you would say that they were overly confident or that they were overly speculative or even greedy. But ultimately, you can't get everybody in those patterns of behavior simultaneously unless they're being prodded by the Federal Reserve with low interest rates and public statements that just didn't accurately represent reality.
I've heard Peter Schiff say before, when people say, oh, Wall Street was drunk, and so when everyone was drunk during this period, that he will point out, say, well, who is it that spiked the punch bowl? And he says, well, similar to you, it was the Federal Reserve.
That's right. That's right. You know, you've got to have a prime cause because, you know, overly speculative individuals, or overly confident individuals, that occurs all the time. But it doesn't occur simultaneously all across the economy, everywhere, not just in the United States, but in other economies that were related to the U.S. economy. In order to explain something like that, you have to have some factor, some causal factor that can expressly influence all of these people simultaneously. So, you know, you can, if in a proper economy, you could get some individuals becoming overly confident and greedy and speculative, but not across the board where you have this giant cluster of entrepreneurial air that occurs, you know, simultaneously all over the economy. It doesn't make sense.
We'll be coming up to break in a moment, but I'll just try and get this question in. Basically, given the boom then that was started by the Fed, the recession that we're going through now, it was inevitable.
Absolutely. Once these all of this capital goes into physical investments that have specific characteristics like houses in Nevada and Florida and elsewhere, or in tech companies or in high-rise skyscrapers, once it goes into physical investments, and then once we try to get back to reality, well, those physical investments were not dictated by market forces. Those investments were directed as a result of central bank interest rate policy and regulatory factors.
All right, cool. Let me just cut you off there for one moment, Mark. We're coming right up to a break now. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio Free Market. Okay, and we're back on Radio Free Market. I'm speaking to Dr. Mark Thornton. And before we went to the break, you were saying that the recession that we're going through now, the bust, it was an inevitable phase that has to happen due to the credit expansion from the Fed. And that's something that Austrians focus on, isn't it, is that they say that the bust is the necessary corrective phase of the boom. So rather than looking at what we're going through now as a really bad thing, which it is, it has to happen. Is that correct?
That is correct. The Austrians have a 180 view of the business cycle. Everybody else looks at the boom as, you know, great, everybody's making money, everybody's partying, everybody's, you know, buying things and spending more and, you know, having a great time. And then the bust or the recession is when people lose their jobs, they lose their homes, they get foreclosed, they go into bankruptcy. That's a bad thing. But if you look at it scientifically, the boom is actually the cause of the problem, where these bad investments are being made, where resources are being misdirected in the economy, where people are being lured from certain jobs into other jobs, where the recession or the bust, it's also called a correction because this is the phase in the economy where prices and wages and everything fall and resources have to be reallocated. So houses go into foreclosure and they get sold to a new owner at a lower price. People lose their job. They go into a different profession and accept a lower wage rate. Businesses and warehouses go into bankruptcy, and they're auctioned off at lower prices for new production and distribution purposes. And so the resources in the society, it's a very painful process. People are losing money. They're losing jobs and so forth. They're facing a lot more anxiety about losing their job or their home or their relatives and their problems and their friends. But this is part of the correction phase, and it's very necessary. It's very important. It's a very important process, and it doesn't have to be a long and drawn out process that can actually happen very quickly. And unfortunately, the government often comes in and tries to prevent this corrective process from happening, and that's a very bad thing.
That's brings me to my next point, is that the typical Keynesian-type argument you'll hear is that the phase we're in now, consumers have basically reined in their spending, which has caused aggregate demand to fall. And so because less people are buying things, businesses are being forced to lay off workers. But if the government can step in here and stimulate the economy by making up for the shortfall by spending money that we as consumers are not spending, then that should reinflate the balloon and get things going again.
I know it is.
But there are problems with this line of reasoning, though, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. They're stepping in the way of the corrective process, and they're only making things more painful and more drawn out. Frankly, Luke, you know, if they hadn't gotten in the way, this crisis would have been over with, and we wouldn't have this show today, because the market economy would surely have cleaned up this mess by now. And what happens is that in a correction phase, prices fall. So the price of capital goods and stocks and physical real estate falls dramatically. The price of labor falls significantly, forcing people out of work at their contracted wages, and brings down the price of consumer goods somewhat, but not very much. And you notice as these different price falls, capital falls tremendously, labor falls significantly, and consumer goods falls just somewhat, this provides an opportunity for entrepreneurs to take that low-price capital, to take that low-price labor, and to reorganizing that into producing consumer goods. And so the farther those capital and labor prices fall, the more likely it is for entrepreneurs to rehire those assets and that labor in order to put it into production for consumer goods, which have not fallen and typically do not fall much in the corrective phase. And so there's a natural shock absorber effect. And what the Keynesians and the government economists are doing is they're saying, well, let's borrow money and spend it from the government. Let's borrow money and give it to the corporations. Let's bail people out. Let's stimulate aggregate demand. Let's have stimulus packages. Let's have public work packages. And what all that government aggregate demand results in is trying to prop up those prices, prop up the price of capital goods, stock prices, real estate prices, try to prop up the wage rates across the economy. And as a result, you stop that corrective price, that corrective process in the economy, and prevent the normal market forces from doing its work of reallocating goods that have been misallocated in terms of capital and labor, and to reallocate it back to what is actually demanded in the market economy at market prices. So it's just the wrong way of doing things.
Yeah, so by the interventions that preventing, like housing prices, for example, to find their actual market value, they're just, at the moment, by propping them up and putting money in there, they're really just an arbitrary figure. It doesn't really mean anything if someone's not willing to pay that amount of money when you don't really know what the value of a house should be.
Yes, and they're making it worse, and they're dramatically increasing the national debt, and they're preventing people from saving and getting their own financial house in order. So it's just a wrong approach of doing it across the board. They're stopping the market process, and they're making the pain a greater quantity and over a longer period of time. It's a shame.
Okay, thanks, Mark. We'll take a break right now, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio Free Market. Okay, and we're back on Radio Free Market. I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton. Just before the bailouts occurred, people were all various different commentators were saying that if they didn't push through the bailouts, if the government didn't do this, that there would have been a financial meltdown. What would you say in response to something like that?
Well, there would be.
But they had to do it. They had to give the bailouts.
No, they didn't have to do the bailouts. They didn't have to do the stimulus, and it would have caused more or less a calamity in stock markets and real estate markets and labor markets. All of those things would have been significantly affected. We also would have had problems in terms of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a lot of other governmental institutions. There would have been a lot more banks that went under. But that would be all to the good. I mean, we've got too many banks. The financial system was overleveraged. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are institutions that are anathema to the market economy, and they've completely distorted the mortgage market, and now they absorb virtually all of the mortgage money in the overall entire economy, and the taxpayer is being forced to back up all this stuff. And so all of their Keynesian plans, all of their government economist dreams about how to save the economy, basically what they've done is they have not saved the economy. They have prevented the restructuring that was necessary in the economy. They have prevented the market from correcting all of the mistakes that took place during the boom. They put the cost of all of this on the American taxpayer. They've driven up the national debt to over $15 trillion and counting, with over $1.3 trillion being added this year. And what have they accomplished? Well, basically, they have not been able to correct the economy. We've got something along the lines of an effective 18% unemployment rate in the United States, if you count all of the discouraged workers and all the people working part-time who would prefer to be working full-time. And then there's all the damage to the people who are working in salary positions, who work on commission, who work on, you know, in terms of the number of customers that they have. There's millions and millions of those people who still have a job but are making a lot less money, 30, 40, 50% less money. And so, you know, despite all of their efforts, despite all of their extreme policy moves at the Fed, at the Treasury, at the White House, in Congress, bailing out companies, nationalizing firms, making direct loans to banks and financial institutions, bailing out AIG, the list goes on and on. These are tremendously large and expensive policy options. They're very radical procedures for government to be engaged in, which normally these things would not be considered legitimate. And nothing has worked in terms of saving the basic American worker, consumer, and so on. They really haven't solved the problem. They've just created a whole new problem that Americans are facing. Now, in addition to, you know, the housing market and the housing crisis, now we have a national fiscal debt problem that has been made 50% worse in just the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And so, you know, this is a whole new layer of uncertainty that faces the American economy going forward. And
do you think there's continue.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Now, do you think there's too much of a preoccupation with consumer spending as an indicator of the health of an economy?
Oh, absolutely. That's another area where Austrians and Keynesians diverge 180%. Austrians see savings as the key foundation of economic progress and prosperity, whereas Keynesians view consumer spending as the most important thing, that if consumer spending is rising, it's driving aggregate demand, and they're fearful of savings. They think savings is a leakage from the system, whereas Austrians view it as the basic building block in the economy, so that when people save, they put money into financial institutions or their own firms, and this money is given to entrepreneurs in the form of loans, and those entrepreneurs take that money to buy capital and to hire labor in order to produce more production. And as production rises, of course, our standard of living rises. But if we just consume, and don't save and invest and take care of depreciating capital goods, and increase the efficiencies of our production techniques, then our consumption levels will actually decline and will regress economically. And, you know, GDP and average income and all those statistics will start to fall. So if we have any preoccupation whatsoever, we should be concerned about savings and having an economy where savings can be quickly turned into loans to entrepreneurs who then put that money to work, where they have enough money to hire workers and other inputs to get the production process from its initial point of where it starts to the point where goods are actually purchased by consumers that can then go back and pay off all of the entrepreneurs on the production chain. So there's no question about it. Logically, you can't really argue against this. Savings is the key, and consumption is something that just naturally flows from this process of savings and then production. And yes, ultimately, consumption rises. But that's not what you should be keeping your eye on. You should be keeping your eye on savings, because that's the key.
Okay, so let me see if I can understand this properly. So the Federal Reserve held interest rates artificially low, which misled entrepreneurs to allocate capital into lines of production that were ultimately unsustainable over the long term. And they're unsustainable because as those projects come closer to fruition, the actual real savings necessary to complete them simply does not exist, and entrepreneurs are competing for a scarce pool of resources, and as they do this, they start to bid the prices up. But as this happens, some of them start to find that their costs exceed the prices that they plan on selling for their goods. So, for example, if I intend on selling like a pair of jeans at $100, yet it costs me $200 to purchase the material, obviously that's not going to last very long. So my question mark really is, can this dilemma at least be partly mitigated if households start to save more now? So as you were saying before, savings is a good thing. We should be saving more during the recession now rather than spending money.
Yeah, that's correct. Savings is the healing salve for an economy in crisis. It helps entrepreneurs. It helps household balance sheets. It helps everything across the board. And you really got to the heart of the matter there, Luke, when you talking about, if we go back to the beginning of the interview where I talked about how Austrians show that the artificially low interest rates increase investment and increase consumption simultaneously, setting off this speculative bubble in the economy. But obviously, if you think about it for a few minutes, if you're increasing investment and consumption, where is all that coming from? Well, eventually the pool of savings is depleted. It runs out. And that's what coincides with the onset of the crisis. Think about it, though. If you're investing and the consumers are buying more, and yet eventually we're going to run low on the pool of savings is going to run out, what happens as all these investments start to come online is that their costs are starting to rise of turning over their loans, of their gas prices, their labor prices. Everything's going up. And yet simultaneously, all of these investments are coming online, bringing on more production so that the prices that they anticipate are going down. So costs are going up, prices are going down, their profits are being squeezed or turned into losses, and that's the signals that tell everybody, hey, we made a mistake here. So we've made the mistake, we go into the crisis. The way we resolve all these mistakes is through savings, that you have to have the savings for those entrepreneurs to take capital, which is depreciated in price, labor, which is offering itself at lower wage rates. That entrepreneur still needs to be able to borrow money or have his own money in order to make those projects feasible, because workers have to be paid on day one. The capital has to be paid up front. And so the more we save, not only do we feel better about our personal household balance sheets, but also more money is available for entrepreneurs, more resources are put at their disposal. So it's ultimately the key ingredient to the corrective process. It's like jet fuel for an airplane. You really have to have that in order to make the whole corrective process work. And the more you have, the faster it's going to go. So it's the fuel that fires the corrective mechanism in the economy during the corrective phase of the business cycle.
So if policymakers were actually serious about bringing about the true recovery, what are some of the other things then that Austrian economists would argue should be taking place right now in addition to small savings?
Well, the central bank should not be inflating, should not be affecting interest rates, should not be trying to finance our way out of the crisis, but we should encourage savings. The government should balance its budget. The government should cut taxes. The government should deregulate. It's very, very important. Regulation in the economy right now is so pervasive and so uncertain right now that there's a sort of a regime that exists of regulatory uncertainty. Look what business people are facing. And you don't have to trust me. You can just go out and ask entrepreneurs, why aren't they starting new companies? Why aren't they hiring? Well, the problem is they face not just a lot of regulation, but a lot of uncertainty with regard to regulation. So banks, for example, they passed this massive bill, but none of it's actually specified so that they know how much capital they are going to be required, what are the conditions of loans and so forth. And so banks are basically frozen in place and unwilling to lend because of regulatory uncertainty. There's a lot of environmental regulation up in the air causing a lot of uncertainty. So there's both existing regulations which drive up their costs and a lot of uncertainty with respect to how the regulations are ultimately going to be enforced. And so the more we cut back in terms of regulation, if we were to deregulate the economy and even just turn the all the regulatory functions over to the states, it would be one giant sigh of relief on the part of entrepreneurs. So entrepreneurs are looking at tax rates, very uncertain, probably going to go up. Tax deductions, very uncertain, probably going to be eliminated or cut back. And then all of these regulations. And then, of course, there's the national debt. And, you know, there's only so much we can borrow without having adverse effects on the entire economy, interest rates, future taxation, and so forth. And we're basically at the point where national debt is 100% of GDP, which is a key level. We also have, in addition to that debt, we have the looming fiscal crisis caused by unfunded future liabilities of the federal government, specifically Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, which are starting actually to start to dip into and into the red. And so, you know, people are looking at that and saying, well, my investments are 25-year investments. And so these investments are going to be made over a time span when, you know, all of these questions out there have not been answered. And they've only been added to, and nobody's even making a dent in resolving any of these issues, solving any of these problems. All of that uncertainty is only looming larger. And as a consequence, people, you know, if they are going to invest, and there's, you know, immigration rules, and, you know, you just look at any aspect of the federal government, and it's up in the air, and it's looking bad, and it's looking very uncertain. But entrepreneurs looking at that are saying, you know, I'm just going to stand pat, or I'm just going to put my investments overseas, or I'm just going to contract that out to overseas firms. And, you know, that's what entrepreneurs are thinking these days. They're not saying to themselves, gee, everything looks certain, everything looks good, the federal government's got a balanced budget, because that really isn't the case. So we've got to resolve basic problems in the government, and we've got to eliminate all of these efforts at Keynesian macroeconomic engineering. You know, that seems to be coming to an end because it's failed. But now we've got to get to work on resolving all this other uncertainty in the economy so that entrepreneurs are ready to go.
Do you think this can be done in one, like in like quite big sort of giant leaps, or does it have to be done in a piecemeal sort of fashion?
I think it has to be done all at one time at the beginning of a presidential term when the president has got 4 years to go and where a large majority of Congress, both the Senate and the House, you know, have terms that look out 2 years and 4 years, and parties, whatever party's in control or whatever parties are in control, feel like they're not going to lose their majority, and you have a radical change in policy that either immediately or sets in place adjustments that will work over time. And so what I would suggest is that that at the beginning of a term that there's radical tax reform and cuts, that there's radical cuts in government spending, where there's radical rollbacks in terms of regulation in the economy, and where plans are put in place to resolve and then ultimately dissolve Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, or turning some of those functions back over to the states, and also immediately putting in place programs that bring Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the Community Reinvestment Act. All of those things need to be phased out at a very fast clip. And so you do the reform comprehensively and radically immediately, but some of those features, such as Social Security, you know, you might be looking at phasing that out over a 25 or 40-year period, depending on the program or the policy recommendation that you found most effective. And there's plenty of plans out there that can do that. So that's the mixture.
Yeah, there's a lot of things there. It would seem to go against a lot of the people. There's certain critics who say that Austrians essentially advocating a do-nothing policy, but obviously that's not true at all.
Oh, no, there's plenty that we...
We're coming up to a break right now, so we will be back in a minute. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton. Okay, and we're back on Radio Free Market. This is Luke McGraw, and I'm speaking to Mark Thornton. You wrote a number of articles that sort of saw quite clearly what was coming up ahead. What do you see then? Do you have any thoughts on the next, say, 5 years or so of what's going to happen in the economy? Can you see anything?
Well, you know, I have an optimistic side that tells me that, you know, hopefully politicians are going to be put into a position where they're going to make some of these Austrian policy recommendations, where they're going to, you know, freeze the budgets and cut back on regulation. We do have some hope for that. But as of right now, I don't see the political parties really coming to an agreement, reconciliation, and, you know, accepting all of these ideas. And if they don't, and we got to hope that they do, and that possibly that the Republicans and the Tea Partiers win a supermajority in the presidency and so forth, and actually make these and implement these policy directives. But if they don't, I mean, what we're faced with is an ever larger national debt, an ever burgeoning regulatory system, and a money supply that's frankly out of control. And the Fed has tripled its balance sheet. And so going forward, I mean, there's a lot to be worried about with respect to the value of the dollar, the stability of capital markets in the United States, the stability of financial markets in the United States, and, you know, a labor market that is very soft and very subject very much to uncertainty in the economy. So, you know, in general, I'd like to be optimistic about the long run. But until we see actual concrete changes in the political system to accept the Austrian remedies and policy agenda, which is large and diverse, then we have to be on guard. We have to maintain our savings, have insurance in the form of gold and silver coins, stable jobs, large family networks of friends and family and business associates, social networking, so forth, so that we can absorb the blows that potentially might emerge as a result of the federal government and its out-of-control budget, and, of course, most especially the central bank of the Federal Reserve, which is also basically out of control and under the control of what you might describe as Keynesian madmen who are committed to an insane policy of zero interest rates for the foreseeable future, forcing more and more credit into the economy via quantitative easing. All of this is in the wrong direction. Of course, the Fed, we need to bring them to an end. We need to stop them from intervening in the federal funds market, phase the other jobs of the Federal Reserve out, auction off all of its assets, and close the books on the Fed as well in the long run. So, heads have got a role in terms of who's in charge, the White House, the Congress, the central bank, the Treasury, and then we can be very optimistic about an economy coming roaring back. But in the meantime, we have to keep our eyes on markets, our ears on Radio Free Market, and our hands on our gold and silver.
It would seem, and you might be a fan of Dr. Ron Paul, and he's a run for the presidency.
Absolutely. I think that he's caused an intergenerational change. I'm very optimistic about what he's been able to achieve and instill in young people who are going to be around for the next 50 years, Austrian economics and all of the scientific understanding that it provides us for the economy and for government and for our economic institutions and federal bureaucracies, all the rest. That's the most encouraging factor that's come out. It's in play, and he's putting a lot of pressure on the political process, and I think that's all to the good, and it's the main reason that I maintain some optimism about what we can accomplish, what we can achieve, and how we can get America back on track.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for that, Mark. I appreciate you being with us today. This is Luke McGraw and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. Until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thanks for listening.